MediTalk with Dr. Ross Walker.
Good afternoon, Dr. Ross Walker. How are you?
Oh, Brent, isn't this wonderful?
How are you feeling this week?
Oh, I'm okay, mate. I've had this weird virally thing for the last week. I don't know if it's a mild dose of influenza, but I've dosed to the eyeballs with supplements and Codral. And I did say the other day when I was giving a lecture to a bunch of pharmacists in the Gold Coast that I've been dosing myself with Codral and throat lozenges. And you probably don't realise this, Brent, but the fellow who invented the throat lozenger recently died, but there was no coffin at his funeral.
Boom, boom. That's very good, Ross. Very good. I got a couple of questions for you. Vitamin D. I had an email last week from a lady. I think her name was Joanne, and she wanted me to ask you about vitamin D. And
yep.
Can we get a test to see if our vitamin D is low? I know the answer to that. The second part of the question is, what can you do to raise your vitamin D?
Yep. Okay. Well, yes. Obviously, you can get a test for it, and tragically, a third of Australians have vitamin D less than 50. So the normal range is 50 to 140 nanomoles per litre, and we like it to be sitting around 100. Some of the recent studies have shown that vitamin D levels around 100. People have lower rates of COVID, COVID complications, COVID death just by getting your vitamin D up to those levels. And the things you can do to raise your vitamin D if it is below 50. So if you naturally have a vitamin D level around 100, congratulations, leave it at that. Don't take supplements. Going out in the sun in the non-burning times, because as we all know, Australia's the skin cancer capital of the world. So going out in the non-burning times before 10 o'clock and after 3 o'clock and getting 15 minutes of sun will certainly give you some vitamin D. But I think the safer way to do it to keep out of the sun is to take 2 vitamin Ds a day. So a big study, and there are 1,000 unit capsules, they're tiny little capsules, they're very inexpensive. A big study out of the US of 25,000 people over 5 years showed that taking 2 capsules of vitamin D a day reduced your risk for autoimmune disease by 25%. That's just one disease. But there's a link between low vitamin D and osteoporosis, heart disease, cancer, multiple sclerosis, type 2 diabetes, depression, asthma, and recently a study showed same thing with dementia as well. So I think it's a good thing to take vitamin D, but it's certainly an important thing to get your level at around 100.
So what do you do? Just say to your GP next time you have those yearly blood tests, I need to add to the blood test that I want to see what my level of vitamin D is.
Absolutely, but I wouldn't be getting it done all the time. But you want a one-off every few years just to make sure your levels are sitting around 100.
Could I ask you a question? What is the difference between, because I had done a little bit of research myself on vitamin D, and I noticed that there is a spray that you can take vitamin D with. Is there any difference between taking a spray and also taking a tablet?
No, not really. You still get the same amount of vitamin D. And the problem with vitamin D is more is not better. So some people take a huge dose and their vitamin D levels get very, very high. And that defeats the purpose. It actually blocks the beneficial effects of vitamin D, and people can get paradoxically more osteoporosis by getting too high a level of vitamin D. But whether it's a spray, whether it's a tablet or whether a capsule, whatever suits people, whatever gets their vitamin D levels up to around 100, that's all you need to be doing.
Is there a test that will tell you if you are prone to have inflammation in your body?
Yeah, there's a simple test called HSCRP. So that stands for highly sensitive C-reactive protein. There's another test called ESR, which is erythrocyte sedimentation rate, but the CRP is a bit more sensitive. And so, for example, we like it less than 5, but if it's less than 1.5, your immune system's really working very well. But, for example, if I had my CRP done now and the tail ends of a cold, it might be sitting around 10. And the worst CRP I've ever seen was a person that had acute severe influenza. Their CRP was 370. Things like leukemia, if you have acute leukemia, it might be 100, 150. Pneumonia could get up to 200. So really bad infections, autoimmune diseases, blood disorders can put it up to that level. But if you had some arthritis in your knee and it was worrying you, it might be 5 or 6. So CRP is just a good general test for inflammation.
And is CRP part of a blood test, Ross?
Oh, if you ask for it, but it's like anything. You don't just go and have a blood test. People say to me, oh, doctor, what's my blood count? I said, I don't know. I didn't measure it.
Right.
You've got to specifically ask for a test to get it done.
And it can be included in other blood tests. Like if you're having a cholesterol test, you can ask for the CRP test.
I ask for, but make sure it's the hs-CRP test, and you can have a vitamin D done at the same time.
Okay. As they say, kill two birds with the one stone. Because it's really important, is it really important that we aren't walking around with an inflamed body because of the fact that it can do bad things to us?
Absolutely. And in fact, people who tend to be overweight, especially in the obese range, they tend to have higher CRPs because that bit of fat in front of your tummy there is not just an ugly lump of lard. It's an inflammatory organ that's inflaming things in the body. So you find people who are obese have much higher CRP rates. So it's a good thing to know because, again, it's very, very interesting. There was a study done which is called the CANTOS trial by one of the world experts in this area, a guy called Paul Ridker in Harvard, where he looked at people after heart attacks and gave them a very, very strong monoclonal antibody as an anti-inflammatory. And he found the people who had the highest CRPs when they had their heart attacks did best with this anti-inflammatory drug, as opposed to the people who just had a slight elevation or no elevation in CRP who did okay but not really that well. So it is important to know.
Okay. Risk of dementia has been linked to high cholesterol.
Yeah, you see, people think when someone gets demented, it's because they're just getting old, and when you get old, your brain doesn't work as well. That's actually nonsense. It's felt that even 40% of dementia risk is due to modifiable risk factors, and the point is, you don't wait till it starts happening. You do things now. So, in middle age, working on things like cholesterol and blood pressure, and getting rid of the cigarettes, and keeping your diabetes under good control, will markedly reduce your risk for getting dementia later on. So we see a lot of people who survive their vascular years who then get this washdown effect of dementia. So think of the big pipes coming out of the dam. They're the big arteries supplying your organs. Then you've got the feeder arteries. Then you've got the microcirculation, which is like the taps and the pipes in your house. And the microcirculation can just get this washdown effect because as all the muck, the cholesterol and the higher blood pressure washes down into the smaller arteries, they get clogged. So when every time you have a thought or an emotion, you generate a waste product that's got to be washed out of the system. So have a thought or emotion in your brain, the waste product just sits there and accumulates because of the reaction. And so if your microcirculation is sluggish and your immune system in the brain isn't working as well, then you get these accumulated things called amyloid proteins. So we now know that there's a link between high cholesterol and these sluggish products occurring in the microcirculation. So they're now doing a big study in Australia to see whether working on these things early will have an effect later on. But a lot of the studies are already suggesting that it does have an effect on reducing your risk for dementia.
Okay, I'm going to let you, the next topic we're going to talk about is it the Helicobacter, you tell me all about how to pronounce it, please.
Helicobacter pylori.
Pylori.
Yeah. A number of years ago, a guy called Barry Warren and Robin Marshall, two guys in Perth, were given the Nobel Prize for finding that this bug, Helicobacter pylori, was the major cause of peptic ulceration, gastroesophageal reflux, etc. So when people say to me, oh, doctor, I'm getting really bad reflux, I want more of that Nexium stuff, I say, no, what you want is a gastroscopy. Because what the gastroscopy does is tell you whether they take a biopsy of the lining of your stomach to see whether you've got this helicobacteria that's set up shop in your stomach. And also it tells you whether you've got a thing called Barrett's esophagitis, which is an inflammation at the lower end of the esophagus as well that can lead to esophageal cancer if you don't treat it. So they're the reasons you need to have a gastroscopy. But what we can do with this Helicobacter pylori is hit you with either double therapy or triple therapy. Typically we use triple therapy, which has got in it, it's got in one of these acid suppressing drugs, and it's got two antibiotics that kill, just dongs this Helicobacter on the head. Because again, if you leave Helicobacter in the stomach, people can perforate their ulcers, get really severe symptoms, but also after 10 or 15 years, the stomach can turn cancerous. So the major cause of gastric cancer is Helicobacter pylori, which is endemic in many parts of Asia. Well, some studies have shown up to 90% of adults in Asia have this living in their stomach, and we see a lot more gastric cancer places in Asia than we do in Australia. But many people in Australia have chronic reflux and problems like that. They need their Helicobacter treated.
Fear and disgust can increase your stomach acid. What's that all about?
Yeah, this was a really weird study of 31 young men, average age 24, who were shown bad videos. I mean, I don't know about you, but I can't stand watching horror movies. I just don't like them. I think they're horrible. Mm-hmm. And they said that people who felt the most disgusted or frightened watching horrible videos, like disturbing videos, had the greatest rise in stomach acid. So what they did with these 31 guys, they got them to swallow these commercially available smart pills, which could measure the acid in the stomach, the temperature in the stomach, and the pressure in the gut. And these videos that elicited this disgust, fear, and unhappiness, the ones that had the worst response had the highest levels of acid. Didn't do anything to the temperature or the pressure, but it certainly released the acid. So it's interesting that you can be really, literally sick to the stomach.
Absolutely. Quick emails come through as a result of our earlier conversation from, I think it's Chris. Chris has said, could you please ask the doctor, what role... This is a good question. What role does alcohol play with inflammation?
Not a huge role in terms of inducing inflammation, but the problem is alcohol is a cellular poison, so it damages every cell in the body, and the problem is the body works in a 24-hour cycle, so it really can stand two or three drinks a day at the very most, and after that it then goes into damage mode. But it doesn't actually cause inflammation, it just causes direct toxic damage. So alcohol doesn't just affect the liver, it affects the liver, especially the electrics and the muscle in the heart, and certainly the brain. So when people say, oh, Dad died of dementia when he was 85 because he had Alzheimer's disease. Yes, he may have had Alzheimer's disease, but he could have also had alcohol-induced dementia. And we're speaking so much these days about chronic traumatic encephalopathy, people who get recurrent belts to their head. And they say, oh, they had dementia. No, they had chronic traumatic encephalopathy causing their dementia.
Obviously, for what you do, and you've been doing it now for many, many years, you consume so much literature. You do a lot of reading. Can I ask you, in reference to the amount of reading that you've done, are you seeing in all of the articles that you read in reference to alcohol that there is a trend for people wanting us to consume less and less and less and less? In fact, some say no alcohol is good for you.
Oh, yeah. Look, on my show a few weeks ago, I spoke about the new guidelines from the Canadian Medical Association suggesting the only safe level of alcohol is probably none, right, or maybe two a week. Now, again, I think that's wowserish nonsense. I think it really depends on who the alcohol hangs around with. So if you're drinking alcohol because you're lonely or because you're depressed, it makes the unhappy chemicals in your body even worse. Whereas if you enjoy a couple of glasses of red, a couple of years ago, I had dinner with a beautiful friend of mine by the name of Brent Bultitude, and we enjoyed a couple of glasses of red wine. And I think the happy chemicals that are released by that experience, they don't hurt you at all at low doses. Now, anyone who encourages people to drink is an idiot. We should not encourage anyone to drink. But if people enjoy a couple of glasses of red wine a few nights a week with a nice meal, I can't see that there's any evidence at all that it hurts you. And in fact, when you look at the evidence out of the Mediterranean, so when you, again, it's who it's hanging around with, when you combine the alcohol with a healthy Mediterranean-style diet, there has been some studies that show a weak health benefit. But a lot of the studies out of America and Canada, they combine the alcohol with a crappy American diet, which is not good for you, and that causes the problem. So I think it's, again, there's a number of factors there, and I would never see alcohol in isolation as a health innovation, but I'd also wouldn't see it as a health detriment if you do it in conjunction with healthy lifestyle and keep the dose down.
You never thought you'd hear this come out of my mouth, but you're obviously aware of what's happened to me. Since the day this happened, which was Australia Day, this lad hasn't consumed 1 ounce of alcohol.
Yeah, and I think it's probably better for the healing with all the things you've been through. So I don't have a problem with that. But again, if you wanted to get back to having an occasional glass of red, I don't think it's going to hurt your health at all. But I wouldn't encourage. I think it's irresponsible for doctors to encourage people to drink. I think it's nuts.
New DNA tests predict your disease risk. But the question is here, if you could have this test and find out what the risks were for you, would you in fact take the test?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question, and this is the problem, because they're talking about these things called polygenic risk scores. Now, what that means is there are many diseases we know about, things like cystic fibrosis, which are just single diseases. There's a thing called familial hypercholesterolemia, hemophilia, all caused by one gene. But the point is, for example, in cardiology, we've mapped over 300 genes for different aspects of cardiovascular disease. So when you do this polygenic risk score, you look at the combination of all of these genes and add them up all together and say, okay, you've got a bit of this gene, a bit of that gene, a bit of that gene, and it's giving you this polygenic risk. So it means that your risk over 10 years for a heart attack because of the fact that you've got all these genes might be about 30% from that. And so what they're saying is we're getting to the point now with genetics where we can test a child when they're born or test someone at age 30 to say what their lifetime risk for a disease is. Now, the question is, do you want to know that? Now, as an anally retentive neurotic that I am, I would want to know it, and I'd do something about it. But this is the problem with Homo sapiens, Brent. As a species, we're a sorry lot. If I line up 100 people and give them all the same program for any condition, after 12 months, 50% of people have stopped. And the people I see in this practice who do the best are the people who practice the five keys of being healthy, no addictions, good sleep, good eating and less of it, 3 to 5 hours of exercise and happiness. That's 80% of anyone's management. 10% is the appropriate use of pharmaceutical drugs if you need them, and 10% is the appropriate use of supplements. But the point is, as I said, after 12 months, 50% of people aren't doing it anyhow. So the question is, what do you do with this information? And also, there are many people I see in here, and we see across the planet, who are incredibly anxious, and you tell them they've got a 50% chance of getting breast cancer or prostate cancer or a heart attack, all that's going to do is worry them. Mm-hmm. So it's a very sort of fine line between what is good information and is going to help people and what's reasonable information is going to worry the life out of them. So we really just can't tell with this.
But it's the individual that has to make, at the end of the day, that decision. If there's a test that can tell them that they may end up with this and they can change their lifestyle and make changes so that, you know, they may not end up with it, that's only a decision they can make.
Yeah, that's why you're as smart as you are, my friend, the fact that you can come out with those sort of comments. And that's what all this is about, I think it should be an individual choice that people want to know. I don't think government should be thrusting these sort of things on anybody. Not that we're suggesting governments are suggesting this, but I'm saying I think it has to be an individual choice. And it's the same thing. I talk about the coronary's calcium scoring all the time. It's not covered by Medicare because, again, I think it should be an individual choice that people have this, and because they're the ones who are more likely to do something about it.
Yeah, very true. Okay, you're going to have to help me here. Two phase three trials suggested a 16-week treatment with a drug called
lebrikizumab
was effective in adults and adolescents with moderate to severe dermatitis.
Yeah, you see, and you think, oh, dermatitis, what are you talking about that for, Ross? Well, I'm talking about it because 20% of children have it and 7% of adults have a degree of atopic dermatitis, otherwise known as eczema. And it can be, although it's only a skin condition, it can be really, really disabling to what happens to people when they get eczema. And at the moment, the treatment of eczema is just really a lot of steroid creams. There is an injection you can have, which is highly effective for this as well. But if you could swallow an oral capsule that would figure out, that'd be good. And so they did this study of about 500 people published in the New England Journal of Medicine. So we're talking about a high-quality journal which does high-quality studies, and found that this particular very strong anti-inflammatory markedly improved their skin, the reduced itch, and they had much better sleep. So it's something of great hope for people with atopic dermatitis.
Atopic dermatitis, there you go. Yep. Let's talk about caffeine very quickly and reduced body fat and type 2 diabetes.
Yeah, well, this is interesting because there are some people who are rapid metabolizers of caffeine, some people who are slow metabolizers of caffeine. Do you know which one you are?
No, I don't. I have no idea.
Well, I have a total idea of who I am. I'm a slow metabolizer of caffeine. So if I drink coffee after 3 or 4 o'clock, I just stare at the ceiling all night.
Okay.
Because I break. But I've got a mate go out for dinner, and he'll have a double shot latte before he goes home and sleeps like a baby. So, because he's a rapid metabolizer of caffeine. But there is an advantage of being someone like me, because if you have one of these genetic abnormalities, which means you don't break down caffeine that well, that you have much lower rates of, or much lower BMI, much lower fat mass, and much lower risk for type 2 diabetes. So it's because caffeine, what it does in people like me is increase what we call thermogenesis, which is heat production, and you burn more calories. So there is an advantage to being very sensitive to caffeine.
Mate, I have completely in the last 2 months changed my diet. I don't drink that much coffee anymore. And I'm eating lots more vegetables. I never ate a lot of vegetables because I just simply didn't like them. And so I'm eating more vegetables and not drinking alcohol. And I've got to say, as an end result, the SOMAC tablet that I used to sort of live on of a weekend when I was having good food and good wine, I haven't taken one in 2 months. So yeah. There you go.
And can I make the point there? You've just made a really important point. People who have 2 or 3 pieces of fruit per day, 3 to 5 servings of vegetables a day, servings about a half a carrot, so it's not a huge amount, but people who have that amount of fruit and vegetables or more have the lowest rates of heart disease and cancer in the community, doesn't do zip to your cholesterol, but it works on your immune system by keeping your immune system healthier. It's a very, very important thing to do.